tempted to say that Malachy needs no introduction, so we won't get one. So over to you, Malachy.
Thank you very much.
That's actually dead, is it?
Okay, first of all, just a few. I mean, there's a bigger conversation happening than I prepared for. I've written a talk, and I'm going to stick with my talk. But just a couple of observations that I think that are worth making at the start. I mean, it is interesting that peace journalism is getting a raw deal here, and it'll probably get a raw deal for me as well. But at least it is a theory about how journalism should be done, and it's when it's broken down, I don't think it's a theory that much of us have much of an objection to. I don't think it clashes very strongly with Declan's idea, for instance, of responsible journalism. But at least noticing a few things, you know, the journalists do change the world that they operate on. And an example of that is that we now start 3 minutes late because Mark is doing an interview. You know, so there's one example. And another interesting observation is that journalists themselves do things differently. You know, Deglan's talk is very much about journalism as the need to report and stick to the facts. The truth is paramount, whereas Mike was very much along the lines of, while asserting that in news reportage, saying we get off the fence, we are attitudinal, we are passionate. You know, so there are differences already in understandings of what journalism is about. So with that said, I'll just plunge on in. Some journalists have been expressing their cynicism about this conference, and John Brewer mentioned earlier the remarks, which were taken up actually by Henry MacDonald, the Guardian's correspondent, who described this workshop in advance as tree-hugging shite. Johnny Saunderson, a cameraman who's worked in several war zones, says it smacks of absurdity and nonsense. Journalists are averse to being told what to do by those outside journalism. They might say things like, "You have mistaken me for someone you have rights over, but I work for an independent private company which makes its own decisions. You think you have something new to tell me about what is wrong with journalism, but I've heard it all already. I hear it every day. We resist regulation by government and goody-goodies and peaceniks because, if we don't, we will end up with ineffectual journalism, and that is just what government, the intelligence services, the banks, and other criminal enterprises would want." But journalists do take criticism every day, from their editors, from the public through letters, from their friends and colleagues, and mostly now through social media, comments on the internet which can be incisively intelligent or cruel and personal. So you need a robust sense of self-worth to get on with the work of writing for the public. Make a mistake in a seminar and someone may correct you, and you'll be embarrassed, or you'll be content to have learned something. Make a mistake in a newspaper article or a radio broadcast, and it's out there in front of hundreds of thousands of people to be mocked. And we all make mistakes. But journalism is, by its very hard-headedness, shrugging off debate about what it does. No one in journalism, I think, would or should defend all journalism. That would be daft. The editor of The Guardian may defend the right of The Sun to report as it pleases, but I doubt he's very impressed by what The Sun does. In times of war, for instance, The Sun cheers on the armed services of the UK. Those who engage in such war journalism cannot reasonably attack peace journalism on the grounds that it's not objective, for war journalism isn't objective either. If journalism is going to take up causes and pursue them, as it does, then I have as much right to ask that they champion my cause as any other. What might their reply be to that? That peace is dull and boring? That peacemaking is social engineering and won't work, that it doesn't produce enough good stories, the devil doesn't just have the best tunes, he has the best yarns too. Before asking if journalism should be promoting peace or doing things differently in times of war and in times of peace or peacemaking, let's ask what it is that journalists ordinarily do, how they view their actions and their purposes. There are some simple answers to this question that you'll often hear. They tell truth to power. Well, they do, but they do a lot of other things too. And they don't all do the same thing. The media is often criticised as if it is a uniform force in our society, the fourth estate. But media is a plural noun. Media activity is diverse within each outlet and across outlets. The Sun is different from the Guardian from the BBC, but within each there is also a huge diversity of approach. The BBC has news reportage and documentary reportage. It has features and light entertainment. It has religious affairs and religious devotion. It has sport and sports news and sports analysis. The Belfast Telegraph has business and health correspondence. It has sport and photography and advertising, as well as incisive and brilliant political analysis. And all of these interact in ways with social media and the internet that could not have been foreseen 20 or even 10 years ago, and will change again in ways that we have not yet foreseen. I remember a meeting of the NUJ in 1972 when someone called for special consideration for photographers covering riots. He said, "The reporter just has to find a phone box and phone in copy. He can do it from the pub, but a photographer has to get back to the office. I don't think we'll ever see the day when you can phone in a photograph. Now there are no copy takers, so the reporter can't dictate but must type, but both can send their work in from a smartphone or a laptop while sitting in the car or at a bar. Journalists do many things, but the primary thing they do is tell stories. Their stories are different from the standard fictional model of Little Red Riding Hood or Borden or a short story in The New Yorker in one crucial way. The news story is told backwards, with the denouement at the start declared in the title or headline. Lionel Shriver has a story in the current issue of The New Yorker which will serve as an example. A feckless young woman freeloads off Westerners in Africa, goes swimming in a river and nearly drowns, reflects for years on how narrowly she survived, then having a casual drink on the roof of a skyscraper, falls off and plunges to her death. Tell that as a news story, and the headline might be, "Woman who fell from rooftop had narrow escape in Africa." And unpacking that story at the very end, we would reach the kind of homely details that made the first paragraphs of the short story. Below the packed few paragraphs at the start of a news story, further information is presented in descending order of interest, not to build suspense, but to discharge it. This stems in part from the practical need to cut stories on the stone to make them fit the page layout by the expedient of removing the last paragraph or two on the understanding that these will be the least interesting part of the story. Anyone who has worked as a journalist will know that for themselves, the mark of their talent is their ability to recognise a good story. They may not reflect much on why they tell stories, on the fact that story making is one of the basic human functions, so basic that we do it in our sleep. I remember my own education in this well. It was my first job as a reporter in the Sunday News, and I was struggling. I would put up ideas for stories to the news editor, and he would knock them down. And I would learn from his responses how he evaluated a story. And I learned that stories could be built on trivial events. I wanted to do one about a family living in a flat at the top of Belfast Castle, when the castle was closed to the public. That family didn't want the attention, so it was a good story if they cooperated. We could have had pictures of perhaps a child on a trike riding down carpeted corridors, but they didn't cooperate. That was another lesson. You can't make stories without access. I trawled the classified ads of the provincial papers, as we call them, and found one about a missing three-legged cat. I phoned a number, heard the sorry story of the cat's misfortune, being left behind by its original family, immigrating to Australia, getting mauled by a dog, being rejected by another cat brought in to keep it company. I wrote up the story of the jinxed cat. This was 1972, during the worst of the troubles. My news editor's assessment? Fucking good story. And that was the day I began to think I might make a good journalist. There was one thing missing from that story, however, and that was topicality. You don't make a living as a freelance doing homely little stories and light features because they get pushed aside by more urgent topical news. It was also a story that had local cultural traction. There are societies in which cats are not regarded affectionately, and cultural attitudes change. We had a story in the paper then about two little girls who were attacked in North Belfast. According to the story, they were stripped of all their clothes and left naked on the street. That story made three paragraphs in the Sunday News in 1972. I think it would potentially be a major story in the tabloids today, in an age with a much closer focus on child abuse and paedophilia. News values change as cultural contexts change, one of the greatest shifts in context being from war to peace, or the other way around. When the Troubles ended in Northern Ireland, news stories featuring routine murders, bombing and kneecappings went into sharp decline. A focus shifted towards ordinary crime, And for a time, we had a feeling that criminality had actually worsened, that the danger of being robbed on the street or killed by your spouse had risen sharply. We even had people arguing that we had been safer during the Troubles when paramilitaries, as they imagined, had held criminals in check. I can recall nights in newsrooms when we sat around bored, smoking, wondering what we might lead with nothing coming in that would make a decent front page headline. Were we wishing for a bomb? Honestly, I think we were. I remember the editor of a Ballymena newspaper telling me that his job was made harder by the BBC reporting low-level crime on the regional news. Previously, he would have had these stories to himself, and he was driven to find even lesser crimes to fill his pages, to have content that his readers would not already have encountered on the radio. When I talk to community groups and others, I am constantly hearing this criticism of the media. They twist what we say. They take perverse angles on our work. We want to tell them the good news of a cross-community football match, and they take an angle on it. They can't just leave it alone. Nor will they. A newspaper is not a bulletin board for community information. It is a platform for stories. And if the news you offer is not a story, they will find a way of turning it into one, or they will ignore it. Killer's son on cross-community football team. Suicide-stricken football team picking up the pieces. Healing division with football. Drug gangs hawking wares to young footballers. Pedo coaches footballers. I'm reminded, by the way, of the maxim, the perfect headline for a newspaper story, which should have sex, violence, sport, and the Second World War, and put them all together and you get lesbian Nazis golf course rampage. Political parties and some community organisations understand this. When I started in journalism, a press release was an invitation to the media to send a reporter and photographer to an event to write it up. Nowadays, there are fewer on the staff of papers, and people find that if they write the story up themselves, it may be published intact, but they have to write journalistically to achieve that. If you were a working journalist, it would be your job to find the angle that turned information into a story. And if you're a community worker trying to get publicity for a cross-community football team, you will have to find ways in which your news can be presented as a story and hope that the lazy journalist will be content with the angle you have chosen. But you do have to make the story interesting. When I talk to media studies students and researchers working on the use of language in the media, I hear the recurring critique that journalists use language which is loaded, sensationalised, sexist, celebrating violence. But it's insufficient to criticise language without providing other visions of how a story might be written. A full critique of one type of storytelling must envisage an alternative type. Take my story about the jinxed cat. Someone might think it is insensitive to animal suffering. Some that it should contain a more positive message to cat owners that they shouldn't just immigrate and leave a cat behind in a home it is not familiar with. We should not just be sneering at the poor thing. We should be using the disappearance of the cat to provide an important lesson for the public. Well and good, but a journalist will say, where is the angle? Cat's misfortune, a lesson to us all? It's not a great headline. The editor probably thinks the reader won't want to be lectured. That would be the job of a columnist anyway. Granted, we might have avoided loaded words like jinxed, which imply a superstitious belief in destiny, the taint of karma, the inevitability of some of us being confined in our misfortune, undeserving of hope or prospects. But stories work best when they rely on tropes which we already understand. I couldn't have written a story about a jinxed dog. We do have to think about the stories that we tell each other and what we want from stories. If journalism is about the purveying of stories, then it has to be founded in understanding of what stories the public wants and will recognise. There are tropes in journalism, as in detective fiction or sci-fi. No one expects a private eye to have a happy home life, or travel beyond the speed of light, really, to be impossible. There's little point in telling people what stories they should want, for they will not pay for them if they don't want them. They will not work to understand them if they don't know the tropes. And the media sells stories and wants to go on selling more of them. You can go over to the Christmas market and set up a stall and try to sell sheep's eyeballs or deep-fried dog's legs. But I'll tell you now, you won't sell any. Maybe next year. Things change. When we criticise the media for not focusing on good news, we have to ask if good news is interesting. For the primary bias of all journalism is towards what will interest an audience and away from what will not interest an audience. If there are stories which we need to know but don't want to know, then there may be some scope for brilliance in journalism to find the angle in the story that will interest us, but there may not. Ask yourself, what is likely to be the most important thing that happened yesterday? It may be something that we will never hear about. A recent television documentary explored the effects on Kaiser Wilhelm of an arm damaged at birth and showed how his being traumatised by quack medicine might have prompted him to go to war. So a consequence of the abuse of one child might have been warfare that resonates among us still. Some journalists have insights into global politics and science and other specialist areas, guerrilla warfare in the Himalayas or the Philippines, but their efforts to tell stories of these will often be scuppered by stories which are more interesting to the wider public, interesting for their being familiar, relevant, local and topical. There was much criticism of British media coverage of the Troubles when it was clear that the death of a soldier featured more highly than the death of a civilian in the national media. But that's what you would expect. The soldier being British, his death was a local story in the British media. I've often seen a political correspondent's face sink as he gets the call from an editor to say that there won't be space for that big story on the peace process because something more compelling has happened elsewhere. A minister's resignation, a bomb, a scandal in the royal family. How many deaths would it take to displace Prince Harry from the front pages if he was photographed leaving a nightclub with, I don't know, Miley Cyrus or Victoria Pendleton? How many more if he was drunk and dishevelled? How many more again if she was too? The things which we will seek fascination from in a newspaper or broadcast documentary may be little different from the themes which enthrall us in other areas of storytelling, literature and the cinema, violence, sex, power, love and romance, intimations of the supernatural. These may not be the most important themes by other perspectives, but they are what we want, and these media outlets which decline for whatever worthy motives to give us them will go out of business. Now that The Simpsons clashes with the 6 o'clock news, many of us prefer to know what Homer is up to than what David Cameron's doing. In the late 1980s, Professor Frank Wright and I had a conversation in his car as he drove me home from a meeting in Peace House. We were discussing the Troubles and the possible moves towards amelioration and reconciliation. I was looking out the window of his car at a wintry and dark Belfast evening of people driving fretfully home, nurses walking up Lisburn Road against the chilly rain, the ambling drunk, and I voiced a thought that had never really occurred to me before either. I said, do you ever consider that the Troubles might not be the worst of our problems? And he was shocked by that, and I fumbled to make my point more clearly. I said, well, there's heart disease. There's the fact of more people dying in the roads than in bombs. And his response was that these were separate problems that could be addressed in their own terms by people working for practical solutions. The Troubles was different. It was a comprehensive problem at the heart of our vision of our society. But the next time I spoke to Frank about a year later, he was beyond being able to concentrate on ideas like those. The tumour in his brain had reduced his power to think coherently in a sustained way. And shortly after that, he was dead. The Troubles hadn't been the most important thing for him. There are some huge events that don't make headlines. How many people have been killed in the war in Syria? We're told more than 100,000. It was a shocking headline. We'll get a similar headline again when the total reaches another big round number. How many were killed by the severe British winter last year? 35,000 more than most other winters. Some of them were probably pensioners who could not afford to heat their homes properly. But this seems somehow acceptable. We can be shown images of people dying and dead in the wreckage of a car bomb. It's harder for journalism to show us the slow, lonely, shivering and hungry death of an old person in an unheated house. Yet if 35,000 people had died from a new virus, the media would have us all in a state of panic about it. But stories are not generated only by journalists. It may be that the job of illustrating deaths by hypothermia and malnutrition falls to campaigning organisations or political parties who can fight for pension increases and higher fuel subsidies for the poor. To do so, they would have to meet the challenge that the media has failed in, to turn the information about the number of deaths into a narrative that would grab attention and hold it. Peace journalism theory, I've got to it at last, makes some criticisms of what it calls war journalism, that all journalists do need to take seriously. The charge that they rely too much on official sources is valid and well made. For a reporter to use a phrase like the international community in contrast to rogue states without noticing that this endorses one side of an international conflict and seeking to create balance is reprehensible and yet common. But to generally dismiss this feeling in journalism as favouring war over peace is a stretch. The same feeling is observed in much journalism that clearly favours peace and peace processes. We have seen that much of the most trite coverage of the peace process in Northern Ireland was driven by a reliance on official sources in the same way, though with the clear objective not of preparing us for further violence, but of generating a climate in which those who rejected the peace process might be handicapped in their efforts to explain themselves. My biggest problem with the concept of peace journalism is its name, where it argues for the expansion of the context of a story, the exploration of the deeper motives of players, hearing the voices of the oppressed, then all that amounts to, as I see it, is a call for higher journalistic standards. I also have doubts about some of the research methods. Jake Lynch's analysis of British journalism about Iran's nuclear programme in Global Media Journal 2006 gauges the tilt towards favouring war by the absence of reference to elements of the wider context, which he itemises, two of the items being nuclear proliferation treaty and oil. But I don't know if this works. Surely the angle of the story determines its direction and provides the basis in whether it's to be judged as well or badly done. If a story in The Guardian was a report of a speech by Benjamin Netanyahu, for instance, is it really to be judged as pro-war for not referring to the oil market? I mean, that's the kind of analysis, an analytical device that's been deployed here. And Lynch's conclusion that The Guardian produced more war journalism than The Spectator is surely a result that throws doubt on the method. Even the peace journalist wishing to extend and deepen the context of a conflict will have to make subjective judgments about what fits and does not fit, is relevant or is not relevant. There are no boundaries on the available context for something as big and complex as a war. So everyone writing about it will have to choose what to consider and what to ignore. Testosterone plays a part in war. Displaced grievances have a part. Sexual abuse and sexual deprivation play a part. Family traditions play a part. The arms market plays a part. Technological innovation plays a part. Ecology plays a part. If there's a prejudice towards listening to power in the journalism called war journalism, then there's a prejudice in peace journalism towards looking for political and social grievances to explain violence. But there are other causes of violence too.